And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Have you ever thought maybe your pet dog or cat could read your mind? Did you ever get the feeling you could understand your animal? Well, you just may have been right on both counts. Today, we explore the question, can we talk with our animals? When your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today, we look at an approach to learning how to communicate with your animals. And I don't mean just using commands, I mean the possibility of finding what many believe is an intuitive pathway, as ancient as time, practiced by people throughout the ages, and finding a new resurgence of acceptance in the postmodern age. In segment two, we take an in-depth look at how to ask your animal to share with you things you may never have known it was thinking, because you did not know how to ask and how to listen. We talk with Marta Williams, who travels the world, helping people learn some powerful means of communicating with their animal friends. I have a personal appreciation for this topic, because it's great to talk with someone with whom I can share my own experiences with animal communication. Everyone needs to listen to part two of today's show. And coming up, we hear the latest version of Al Gore's presentation on global warming. He's setting the stage for action, and we're about to begin. So now, the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith. I heard on the news today that around the world, in many developing nations, people are beginning to riot because they can no longer afford food. In Haiti, people are eating dirt patties to keep from starving because the cost of food has doubled in the last number of months. There are many problems emerging on this Earth right now, and many of them are the direct result of the attempts by a few to create a global economic order. The pursuit of the good life for the many has been based to a large degree on raising some people's boats high above the rest, with the hopes that some form of trickle-down distribution system will raise the boats of those at the bottom. This international system has created a miraculous world that is competing so directly with the natural systems by their glamour, luxury, ease, and myriads of other factors that whole segments of the cultures of the planet are leaving their farming and agricultural ways, fighting for jobs to get money, to buy food that a few years earlier they were growing themselves. But this economic looping is breaking down, and we are only beginning to feel the effects. Global warming is part of that looping. No one person could adequately define it to everyone's satisfaction. But most of us get it. And the man who has done more single-handedly to define the effects of the breakdown of our climate systems, with subsequent added impacts on farming, food production, and so much more, is joining us now to bring us the latest version of his legendary slideshow. You will find many of the slides printed on today's show page to help you follow his explanation. So, without further ado, I wish to welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, Al Gore.
I have given the slideshow that I gave here 2 years ago about 2,000 times. I'm given a short slideshow this morning that I'm giving for the very first time. So, I don't want to raise the bar. I'm actually trying to lower the bar. Because I've cobbled this together to try to meet the challenge of this session. And I was reminded by Karen Armstrong's fantastic presentation that if Religion, really properly understood, is not about belief, but about behavior. Perhaps we should say the same thing about optimism. How dare we be optimistic? Optimism is sometimes characterized as a belief, an intellectual posture. But as Mahatma Gandhi famously said, you must become the change you wish to see in the world. And the outcome about which we wish to be optimistic is not going to be created by the belief alone, except to the extent that the belief brings about new behavior. But the word behavior is also, I think, sometimes misunderstood in this context. I'm a big advocate of changing the light bulbs and buying hybrids, and Tipper and I put 33 solar panels on our house and dug the geothermal wells and done all of that other stuff. But as important as it is to change the light bulbs, it's more important to change the laws. And when we change our behavior in our daily lives, we sometimes leave out the citizenship part and the democracy part. In order to be optimistic about this, we have to become incredibly active as citizens in our democracy. In order to solve the climate crisis, we have to solve the democracy crisis. And we have one. I have been trying to tell this story for a long time. I was reminded of that recently by a woman who walked past the table I was sitting at, just staring at me as she walked past. She was in her 70s, looked like she had a kind face. I thought nothing of it until I saw from the corner of my eye she was walking from the opposite direction, also just staring at me. And so I said, "How do you do?" And she said, "You know, if you dyed your hair black, you would look just like Al Gore." Many years ago, when I was a young congressman, I spent an awful lot of time dealing with the challenge of nuclear arms control, the nuclear arms race. And the military historians taught me during that quest that military conflicts are typically put into three categories: local battles, regional or theater wars, and the rare but all important global world war, strategic conflicts. And each level of conflict requires a different allocation of resources, a different approach, a different organizational model. Environmental challenges fall into the same three categories, and most of what we think about are local environmental problems: air pollution, water pollution, hazardous waste dumps. But there are also regional environmental problems, like acid rain from the Midwest to the Northeast, and from Western Europe to the Arctic, and from the Midwest out to Mississippi into the dead zone of the Gulf of Mexico. And there are lots of those. But the climate crisis is the rare but all-important global or strategic conflict. Everything is affected. And we have to organize our response appropriately. We need a worldwide, global mobilization for renewable energy, conservation, efficiency, and a global transition to a low-carbon economy. We have work to do. And we can mobilize resources and political will. But the political will has to be mobilized in order to mobilize the resources. Let me show you these slides here. I thought I would start with the logo. What's missing here, of course, is the North Polar ice cap. Greenland remains. 28 years ago, this is what the North Polar ice cap looked like at the end of the summer at the fall equinox. This last fall, I went to the Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, and talked to the researchers here in Monterey at the Naval Postgraduate Laboratory. This is what's happened in the last 28 years. To put it in perspective, 2005 was the previous record. Here's what happened last fall that has really unnerve the researchers. The North Polar ice cap is the same size geographically. It doesn't look that quite the same size, but it is exactly the same size as the United States minus an area roughly equal to the state of Arizona. The amount that disappeared in 2005 was equivalent to everything east of the Mississippi. The extra amount that disappeared last fall was equivalent to this much. Comes back in the winter, but not as permanent ice, as thin ice, vulnerable. The amount remaining could be completely gone in summer in as little as 5 years. That puts a lot of pressure on Greenland. Already around the Arctic Circle, this is a famous village in Alaska. This is a town in Newfoundland. Antarctica. Latest studies from NASA, the amount of moderate to severe snow melting of an area equivalent to the size of California. They were the best of times, they were the worst of times. The most famous opening sentence in English literature. I want to share briefly a tale of two planets. Earth and Venus are exactly the same size. Earth's diameter is about 400 kilometers larger, but essentially the same size. They have exactly the same amount of carbon. But the difference is, on Earth, most of the carbon has been leached over time out of the atmosphere, deposited in the ground as coal, oil, natural gas, etc. On Venus, most of it is in the atmosphere. The difference is that our temperature is 59 degrees on average. On Venus, it's 855. This is relevant to our current strategy of taking as much carbon out of the ground as quickly as possible and putting it into the atmosphere. It's not because Venus is slightly closer to the sun. It's three times hotter than Mercury, which is right next to the sun. Now, briefly, here's an image you've seen. It's one of the only old images, but I show it because I want to briefly give you CSI climate. The global scientific community says man-made global warming pollution put into the atmosphere, thickening this, is trapping more of the outgoing infrared. You all know that. At the last IPCC summary, the scientists wanted to say, how certain are you? They wanted to answer that 99%. The Chinese objected, and so the compromise was more than 90%. Now, the skeptics say, oh, wait a minute. This could be variations in the energy coming in from the sun. If that were true, the stratosphere would be heated as well as the lower atmosphere. If it's more coming in. If it's more being trapped on the way out, then you would expect it to be warmer here and cooler here. Here is the lower atmosphere. Here is the stratosphere. Cooler. CSI climate. Now, here's the good news. 68% of Americans now believe that human activity is responsible for global warming. 69% believe that the Earth is heating up in a significant way. There has been progress, but here is the key. When given a list of challenges to confront, global warming is still listed at near the bottom. What is missing is a sense of urgency. If you agree with the factual analysis, but you don't feel the sense of urgency, where does that leave you? Well, the Alliance for Climate Protection, which I had in conjunction with Current TV, who did this pro bono, did a worldwide contest to do commercials on how to communicate this. This was the winner. NBC, I'll show all of the networks here, the top journalists for NBC asked 956 questions in 2007 of the presidential candidates. Two of them were about the climate crisis. ABC, 844 questions, two about the climate crisis. Fox, two. CNN, two. CBS, zero. From laughs to tears, this is one of the old tobacco commercials. So here is what we're doing. This is gasoline consumption in all of these countries. And us. But it's not just the developed nations. The developing countries are now following us and accelerating their pace. And actually, their cumulative emissions this year are the equivalent of where we were in 1965, and they're catching up very dramatically. The total concentrations by 2025, they will be essentially where we were in 1985. If the wealthy countries were completely missing from the picture, we would still have this crisis. But we have given to the developing countries the technologies and the ways of thinking that are creating the crisis. This is in Bolivia over 30 years. This is peak fishing in a few seconds. The 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. We have to stop this. And the good news is that we can. We have the technologies. We have to have a unified view of how to go about this. The struggle against poverty in the world and the challenge of cutting wealthy country emissions all has a single, very simple solution. People say, what's the solution? Here it is. Put a price on carbon. We need a CO2 tax, revenue neutral, to replace taxation on employment, which was invented by Bismarck. And some things have changed since the 19th century. In the poor world, we have to integrate the responses to poverty with the solutions to the climate crisis. Plans to fight poverty in Uganda are mooted if we do not solve the climate crisis. But responses can actually make a huge difference in the poor countries. This is a proposal that has been talked about a lot in Europe. This was from Nature magazine. These are concentrating solar renewable energy plants linked in a so-called supergrid to supply all of the electrical power to Europe, largely from developing countries. High voltage DC currents. This is not pie in the sky. This can be done. We need to do it for our own economy. The latest figures show that the old model is not working. There are a lot of great investments that you can make. If you are investing in tar sands or shale oil, then you have a portfolio that is crammed with subprime carbon assets. And it is based on an old model. Junkies find veins in their toes when the ones in their arms and their legs collapse. Developing tar sands and coal shale is the equivalent. Here are just a few of the investments that I personally think make sense. I have a stake in these, so I'll have a disclaimer there. But geothermal, concentrating solar, advanced photovoltaics, efficiency, and conservation. You've seen this slide before, but there's a change. The only two countries that didn't ratify, now there's only one. Australia had an election. And there was a campaign in Australia that involved television and internet and radio commercials to lift the sense of urgency for the people there. And we trained 250 people to give the slideshow in every town and village and city in Australia. A lot of other things contributed to it, but the new prime minister announced that his very first priority would be to change Australia's position on Kyoto. And he has. Now, they came to an awareness partly because of the horrible drought that they have had. This is Lake Lanier. My friend Heidi Cullen said that if we gave droughts names the way we give hurricanes names, we would call the one in the southeast now Katrina, and we would say it's headed toward Atlanta. We can't wait for the kind of drought Australia had to change our political culture. Here's more good news. The cities supporting Kyoto in the U.S. are up to 780, and I thought I saw one go by there just to localize this, which is good news. Now, to close, we heard a couple of days ago about the value of making individual heroism so commonplace that it becomes banal or routine. What we need is another hero generation. Those of us who are alive in the United States of America today, especially, but also the rest of the world, have to somehow understand that history has presented us with a choice. Just as Jill Taylor was figuring out how to save her life while she was distracted by the amazing experience that she was going through. We now have a culture of distraction, but we have a planetary emergency. And we have to find a way to create in the generation of those alive today a sense of generational mission. I wish I could find the words to convey this. This was another hero generation that brought democracy to the planet. Another that ended slavery and that gave women the right to vote. We can do this. Don't tell me that we don't have the capacity to do it. If we had just 1 week's worth of what we spend on the Iraq war, we could be well on the way to solving this challenge. We have the capacity to do it. One final point. I'm optimistic because I believe we have the capacity at moments of great challenge to set aside the causes of distraction and rise to the challenge that history is presenting to us. Sometimes I hear people respond to the disturbing facts of the climate crisis by saying, oh, this is so terrible. What a burden we have. I would like to ask you to reframe that. How many generations in all of human history have had the opportunity to rise to a challenge that is worthy of our best efforts, that has a challenge that can pull from us more than we knew we could do? I think we ought to approach this challenge with a sense of profound joy and gratitude that we are the generation about which 1,000 years from now, philharmonic orchestras and poets and singers will celebrate by saying they were the ones. that found it within themselves to solve this crisis and lay the basis for a bright and optimistic human future. Let's do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Al Gore. Yes, we are entering a new era here on planet Earth, and we certainly can do what is necessary to get this done. But the operative word here, as always in critical missions, is necessary. It is time to do the necessary, and that is what we will continue to reveal here each week on the most important 15 minutes on Earth, the Weekly Earth Summit. In just a moment, we help you learn how to talk with your animals here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.